Welcome to our next episode of All About Dog. I'm Kathy Stone.
And I'm Julia Elliott.
And I'm really pleased that Camp Owl Lawrenceville is a sponsor of us because the information that we give out is very important to both us and all of the employees and the staff at Camp Owl Lawrenceville. Today, since Julia has decided she's going to get dog, she has some questions.
I do. And I think the burning questions in my head are now I've decided I want to get this dog, but how do I keep it healthy? How do I make sure that I'm keeping up with vaccines? What vaccine should I get? And you know, there's so much controversy now over whether I should even vaccinate my kid or my dog or anything like that. So really that's kind of my next step in this process is now how can I make sure that the animal I get is going to be healthy, is going to live a long and happy life, and I'm doing all the things that I need to do.
Right. When I was a kid, we had a cat that caught distemper. Mm-hmm. And I was only about 5 years old, and I remember how painful it was to watch that poor animal go through what they mm-hmm. did as distemper. And of course, back then, you didn't, certainly didn't do cats. You didn't vaccinate yeah. any animals. You just let them be animals, quote unquote.
Yeah.
So now that we consider them part of the family, I think this is a really important topic.
I think so too. And, you know, working in the animal industry, seeing the animals at the pet store too, when they get sick, you know, it's something that you always wonder, could I have done something to prevent this? Is this something that could happen to my own dog? And again, you know, with kennel cough and being around other dogs, that's all the things that I need to learn about. I need to understand to make sure that I am doing what I can and I'm doing my part. And what I want to also have our viewers in mind is it's not just about protecting my dog. I want to make sure that I'm also protecting my dog and your animals to make sure that I'm not spreading something that I could have prevented. And, you know, the big topic, the rabies vaccine, that's such a big, big vaccine that we need to make sure that we're giving to our animals. So yeah, I'm really, really excited to yes. learn. And, you know, as every viewer I'm sure knows now, I ask a lot of questions. There are a lot of things that I don't know. So I'm sure this will be no different.
Welcome everyone to All About Dog. Today, we're very, very pleased to introduce Dr. Jonathan Bentley. You want to talk about him a little bit, Julia?
Sure. Dr. Bentley is with Sugar Hill Animal Hospital. And Dr. Bentley, if you wouldn't mind, just kind of share with the viewers a little bit about yourself, kind of what got you interested in the space, what attracted you to Sugar Hill specifically, and kind of just what made you so interested in this type of position.
I guess I can give you the cliche answer is I've always been really fascinated with animals, even at a ridiculously young age. My parents wouldn't allow us to have many, many pets growing up. So I remember every time I went to the pet store, I would ask for a pet book or go to the library, ask for like something on dogs, something on cats, something on lizards and fish. I mean, I just had this amazing library, just about animal books and animal facts. Then as I guess I got older, I was really interested in people at the same time, which is weird. Some people say that you get into veterinary medicine because of animals to people. But what is really fascinating to me as I got older and worked as a technician, volunteered, et cetera, and then kind of in this job where I am right now, is just that connection, that human-animal bond. It's amazing. It yeah. is amazing what people will tell you about their cats. It is so interesting. Yeah. I know, we're a dog channel here, but I got this. It's amazing the detail about when people have, let's go back, when people have multiple dogs, how detailed they go into each of their own personalities. It's amazing. And then I married a pet lover, cat lover and dog lover, who's also very interested in animals as well. So it kind of helped me going in that respect. As far as the role of Sugar Hill Animal Hospital, I wasn't always the most, I guess, proactive individual when it came to looking for externships at the time. I had a couple externship positions that kind of fell through. So I remember randomly I was cleaning the house where my parents, kind of where I grew up in Stockbridge, Georgia. And I found a bottle of ear cleaner, old school ear cleaner. I didn't have any, really had too many labels on. This has got to be like early 90s. But I remember that even though all the labels were worn, Sugar Hill Animal Hospital. on it. I'm like, oh, yeah. We used to live in Sugar Hill many, many years ago. Oh, I'll just give them a call and see if they have any extern positions available. And it was basically almost love at first sight.
Cool.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Cool. It's a really, really cool vet for our viewers that live in the area. It's a really, really nice vet's office. It's very big. It's very different than most vet's offices that you see. So it's definitely a really, really cool place.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for the shout out. I'm definitely proud of it myself. And I like what we offer for them. For a lot of our clients. And then we have different vets that almost, I wouldn't say specialize in different things, but there are some veterinarians who I feel like, what I like is that we have six doctors and we can all basically see and do some, you know, the same things, but there are some doctors that specialize in different things, which I like it because it allows kind of like a one-stop shop for a lot of our clients and patients at the same time. So a good example would be, let's say we have a dog with orthopedic issue. Dr. Siebert is the doctor you want to talk to. Let's say you have a doctor with an internal medicine issue or skin issue. Dr. Schuler, Dr. Doggett is great. Let's say you have a guinea pig issue. Let's say you have some puppy questions. Then Dr. Johansson is amazing. And we have all these great doctors in one location, which I really, really like.
Cool. Speaking of puppies, in our podcast, Julia has decided to adopt a dog.
So
now she needs to know all about vaccines and why and where and how. And so Julia, you got some questions?
Yeah, I think the one thing, you know, you're constantly hearing from different vets and different people, you need certain vaccines. You don't need some vaccines. There's this vaccine that's available, but you don't really need it type of stuff. And I know one of the biggest ones is probably the Bordetella. You know what I mean? Like some places don't require it. Some places do, but it's recommended. So what's your experience with having a new puppy just coming home at a very small age, your opinion on vaccines in general, or if there's specific vaccines that you think I should for sure make sure I'm getting off the bat, or if there's some that I might want to wait on?
Okay, definitely. So we'll go very, very broad first. That's how I usually have these public conversations, and I'll kind of go in and go very specific a little bit later on. So when you have a new puppy, and I have a new client that comes in, hey, I got this little cute little pupper snuffer or whatever. I usually ask, okay, what's going to be our lifestyle? Is this going to be a little dog who's going to be a hiking family dog? Are going to take our friend camping? Are you going to be one of those people who likes to travel? Things happen, you know, you're going to have to board a dog. Is this a long-haired dog that will need to be groomed, et cetera? Are you one of those who's going to take your dog to puppy daycare? So if you fall into the realm of, hey, this is just my own personal dog, I'm not going anywhere. We don't travel that much. We live kind of like in, let's say, very nice part of Swanee townhouses, which the dog's probably not going to go outside. This is a dog that I say, okay, well, first thing we're most likely going to have to do, and this is legally required in the state of Georgia, is the rabies. We'll get to when we do those vaccines a little later on. And then I work from that specific vaccine that we know we have, legally required in Georgia, and I get to more to the nitty gritty. Now, the core vaccines that I consider for this sort of dog is going to be your rabies, distemper parvo vaccine, and then I also put the kennel cough vaccine in there as well, just as, you know, younger puppies and things are going to change. So the core vaccines and that DHP vaccine that you're going to see probably from your breed or from the rescue paperwork has the distemper. And distemper is a virus that can cause really bad pathology in, let's say, the brain, chest, can also cause really bad GI disease at the same time. Now, the thing about distemper is it's also in the environment. So it's not just dogs who get this. Cats get this too. Skunks get this as well. Foxes, ferrets, and then recently I've discovered even seals can get this disease. So wow. It's already out and about in the environments. So this is a vaccine that I definitely recommend that we need to have. Then there's the canine hepatitis. So not, I guess you could say, as common nowadays as part of your core vaccine, but in certain areas, underdeveloped areas, very, very rural parts of the United States, you can see this as well in young puppies, usually under the age of about 6 months. And then parvo is the big one. Parvo is so big because parvo, the virus attacks the actual cells that line the GI tract. So these dogs get this really, really bad, really smelly, bloody diarrhea. But what makes it so interesting is that parvo is, I think, one of the more contagious of the viruses that we see. So you can get this from direct contact from one puppy to another puppy that may be parvo positive, not know it yet, and then take that virus to your own family. So it becomes almost like indirect transfer, like a fomite.
I did not know that.
It's very, very common. I think we had a couple of really bad strains, I recall, as a technician kind of towards South Georgia. And I remember wearing the gloves and the gown and everything, because this is so contagious. You don't want this virus traipsing through your hospital. You certainly want to make sure that the owner is not taking this home. And that's one of the things we will sometimes test for if we have a young unvaccinated puppy displaying signs of like vomiting, diarrhea, not eating, et cetera. So those are the big baddies that I recommend.
And parvo is pretty fatal for puppies as well, is it not? Or is that?
No, Kathy, you're absolutely right. It is probably, I know when I was a tech and I used to explain this to some of my clients, we used to call it one of the bigger puppy killers in that Henry County area.
Yeah, and it's just, it's so hard to treat too, right? It's just one of those ones that once you get it, you kind of, it's a 50-50.
Once you get it, it kind of depends upon the age of the animal. So let's say we get it young and it's very, very sick. It's definitely a 50-50, Julia. But let's say you get it, the dog, you know, it's kind of okay. It's really supportive care at this point. You're going to have massive fluid losses from vomiting and diarrhea, and the puppy's not going to want to eat, so your blood sugar goes down. You can also get secondary bacterial infection. So what happens when you have the lining kind of slough away from the GI tract, you have, you know, good and bad bacteria. Sometimes there's translocation of that bacteria into the actual bloodstream. We call it bacteremia. So it's almost like, imagine a cold on steroids, basically, all focalized in the GI tract. So the only real way to cure it, there's no real way to cure it. We just have to get that puppy supported for as long as we possibly can and allow its immune system an opportunity to fight back. So it becomes a very expensive battle with IV fluids, hospitalization. They usually stay in the hospital on average about 48 nights, if you're lucky. I know that as a tech, we had a couple that always end up staying for about 4 to 5 days. Up here in Gwinnett, the ones that I have seen usually stay an average of two and a half days. Usually once the puppy is eating, barking, and being, you know, basically a normal puppy, we're usually clear to say, okay, the dog's eating, doing great, diarrhea subsiding. We'll usually send them home with maybe some oral antibiotics. So when I have these puppy talks, Julia, part of the conversation is also going to be, you know, until this guy's completely protected, the guy just stays around your property. You don't take it to the neighbors because you don't know what's going on next door. You don't take it to a friend's house because you don't know what they have going on. The parvovirus can stay in the environment for months. It just goes outside to use the bathroom. It comes right back inside. And usually we'll have that conversation, a reminder, usually every couple of boosters. And we'll get to that in a minute. But usually I tell people, once we're past that 3-booster mark, I'm usually a little bit more lenient as far as where they can take their puppy, et cetera. So going back to the core, you know, we got to have to do rabies, usually as soon as 3 months. Usually it's around 16 weeks when we do 15, 16 weeks when we end up doing the rabies vaccine. Now, let's say if you're going to get this puppy from a breeder, you're going to see a list of vaccines already on there. Breeders definitely will vaccinate for the parvovirus. Sometimes it's just a little bit on the soon side. And this is where I get kind of technical. So if I lose you, Julia, and say, hey, this is not interesting, this is boring, I don't want to hear about it, just say, Dr. Bentley, stop talking science, mumble jumble. Just get to the
point. I'm like you. I could listen to this stuff all day. So go on.
I, on the other hand.
All right. I know we got time, Chris. So we know that we're using different forms of immunity to our advantage with these booster vaccines. So there's innate immunity, but what I'm more interested in is adaptive immunity. And what's very fun about adaptive immunity is there's a aspect of it called immunomemory. Now, basically, so imagine you take a quiz, et cetera. You're exposed to something new in this pop quiz. You recognize some of the answers. You don't do as well. Let's say someone gives you that same quiz. You recognize those answers. Like, oh, yeah, they asked me this the last time. Okay, I know what to do with this. I know 2 + 2 = 4. Okay, I know what I'm doing. All right. So that's where the cell memory comes from. That first quiz, pop quiz, you're exposed to, let's say a virus, a weakened virus, attenuated virus, and we'll get to those different types a little bit later on. So that's the first quiz. You realize what you're supposed to do. So instead of, in this analogy, your brain, you have your types of white blood cells, your lymphocytes, they create antibodies or memory, which provides memory as far as what the exact response should be to this virus or to this pop quiz. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah.
I got a million of these. I recently just liked the pop quiz analogy.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Sometimes works is there's a thing called maternal derived antibodies. Unlike with, and this is where I'll sometimes compare human immunology to canine immunology or cat immunology. So in the human world, you're familiar with what the placenta is, basically like a connection between the little baby and the mom, in which nutrients and sometimes waste will transfer. In the human, you have these preformed antibodies that the little baby receives. In the dog, you don't have that antibody transfer. Why is that important? Because they're going to get that transfer from what is known as colostrum, also known as first milk. Now, we don't know exactly when, 100% when these antibodies in the mom, from the mom tend to kind of decrease and the puppy's own innate or adaptive immunity starts to increase. So we do boosters to try to catch this immunity change at certain points. The other reason is, when I'll tell people is this, sometimes with a human, there's 1, 2, 3, maybe childs at the same time. So imagine you have a litter of 5 little babies, each trying to obtain mommy's milk, etc. I can guarantee you that some are going to be the all-stars. They're going to get more milk, more colostrum, more immunity from mother than the actual runch will. So we're trying to, again, catch that immuno-naive stage and use it to the best of our advantage. So let's say we do, the breeder gives the puppy vaccines at 4 to 6 weeks, kind of early. Name of the game is to usually do it by week 8, usually about 3 or 4 weeks later. And let's say, I like to do 3 to 4 weeks versus 2, because that's less vaccines they need. But let's say we do week 8, booster again, week 12, booster again, week 16, and maybe one more booster, depending upon what we're doing. Because we don't know exactly when the mom's immunity is going to break down and when their own immunity is going to kind of kick in. We know it's around that eight week time frame, but we're not 100% sure. There's also breed differences as far as how they respond immunologically. There are some dogs, I'm not going to pick on any breeds because all breeds are equal in my eyes, but there are some breeds of dogs that do not follow or don't have the same degree of adaptive immunity as others. And that's neither really here or there. So I'm not going to say, just only get this breed. That's not what I'm saying. I am saying that you need to realize that's part of the reason why we do so many boosters in the first year of life.
Yeah.
We're trying to get that adaptive immunity. We don't know how they're going to respond. There are some in the percentage that are even called non-responders. Usually about 1 in every 2 to 5,000 puppies just won't respond immunologically. And that's one of the reasons I think after whole puppyhood vaccines, we're probably going to do a distemper or so yearly, kind of depending upon the dog and what the lifestyle is going to be. Did I go off train there?
No, I think it's good. I think it'll lead me kind of into one of the other questions I have. So I have a dog now. She's 6 now. She's a Boston Terrier. She went her whole life not having any issues with vaccines, got them the time she was supposed to get them. But then I went maybe a year ago, and all of a sudden they gave her shots. We left 5 minutes after we left. I noticed her gums got really white. Mm-hmm. And so I turned right back around and brought her in, and they said she was having an allergic reaction to something, which she's never had before. They weren't able to pinpoint which vaccine it was because she had 5 or 6 vaccines given that day. The only difference in the shot was she went from like the year rabies to, I think, like the 5-year rabies shot. So like maybe it was a rabies shot.
Right.
We're not really sure. So what are some vaccines, if you can even give an answer to that, that those type of reactions might happen to? Is it dependent on age? Like, is it something that they could develop later in life that they might have not had as a puppy? Kind of, what's your experience with that?
I feel like there's some breeds that are more predisposed to having vaccine reactions than others. So I think I will say Bostons, I will say Chihuahuas, Dachshunds tend to be a little bit more overrepresented in the population. Mm-hmm. There are some vaccines that, according to the science, I feel like it should not be. So empirically, it should not be this way, but I feel like anecdotally, personally, I've seen reactions. So as a technician, I've seen reactions to the leptovaccine. Mm-hmm. Lepto is a virus, or bacteria rather, not a virus, a bacteria you can get from wildlife reservoirs. A little bit different from distemper. Usually I see more lepto kind of around the wooded areas. Very, very common, really in certain parts of Gwinnett, Flowery Branch area, and definitely very common where I used to work as a technician down in South Georgia. So Henry County, Locust Grove, things of that nature. Kidney disease, really bad. Liver disease can be potentially fatal. But I have seen booster reactions to lepto. Sometimes I'll see it to the distemper. I guess for me, what's so hard is your friend got about 5 different boosters. So it's hard to pinpoint exactly which one. So sometimes you have to go with, hey, well, this one is new. And if I'm if I have this sort of encounter, I'll say, okay, let's try maybe the 1-year rabies this time. Or if the client is willing, I'll say, let's break up these vaccines just a little bit.
Yeah, maybe that's what I started to do.
Maybe instead of doing everything at once, maybe just if the owner's amenable to this, doing a booster maybe every 2 to 3 weeks. So let's say you come in for your rabies, 2 weeks later, there's no problems. Come back, we'll do the distemper. And usually I do like a 3-year distemper for a dog of that age. It is less vaccines at this time, as long as our friend's not really reactive. But given your friend's case, I'll take with a 1-year distemper, see how our friend does.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. So do you think it might have had something to do with the fact that it was a 1-year vaccine to a 5-year vaccine? Explain that difference in those type of vaccines that where you have the choice of going longer or shorter.
Right. I guess the best way to simplify it is there's an ingredient in your 3-year vaccines that usually allows for, I guess, a slower introduction of these antigens to the adaptive immunity. So it does, you're getting this, your body's responding, you're still getting this, your body's responding. So it forms, I guess, a little bit more of a longer immuno memory. Oversimplifying it a little bit, but I think for this case, we'll go with that route. There are some counties that prefer like a 1-year versus a 3-year. I think Hall versus Gwinnett used to be the case. With some of those things like your 3-year distempers, it's been shown that some of those vaccines are kind of modified live. So that means they're not full strength. They're kind of much weaker. Do provide longer lasting immune memory or adaptive memory, et cetera. And by doing that, by changing, I guess, the concentration and the, I guess you can say the proprietary ingredient is a fancy way of saying that changes how the vaccine is perceived by the immune system. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, it does.
With these things. That doesn't respond, doesn't help me, doesn't compute. Then you can just tell me, Julia, that's fine.
No, that was good. Kathy, are there any questions that I'm not thinking of right now that...
I have actually 2 that are kind of buzzing around in my head. And I personally have not had a dog for a number of years now. I have a camp full of grand dogs. And I was
about to say, she's got hundreds of grand dogs.
Two questions. We have a number of folks who think they can give their own vaccines. You said that rabies was the only one required by the state of Georgia.
Yes.
Can folks give their own distemper, Bordetella? I mean, obviously, if there's going to be a reaction, you want it at the vet's office rather than at your home. But I mean, that's not illegal for people to do, right?
No, it's certainly not illegal. I think when I have this conversation brought up to me by certain clientele, This vaccine that I get here that comes to my clinic is packaged a certain way, stored a certain way before being packaged, and then stored a certain way after being packaged. And there's usually like a warranty or a guarantee provided by the actual company providing this vaccine for us. You're not going to get the same sort of protection, if you will, if you were going to get this vaccine from a feed store. Can you 100% guarantee that the same vaccine you get from Tractor Supply is going to give you the same degree of protection as if you were to get it from actual veterinary clinic?
Right, because I'm sure people are going, I can save money by doing it myself.
I know. A lot of it is, and Julie, that's part of the conversation with a new puppy owner, is we got to establish like a trusting role and there's got to be a relationship between me and the dog, you and the dog, and me and you at the same time. When it comes to vaccines, we kind of form like a advisory role. So I'll give you input as far as, you know, you may want to consider doing things this way. I see where you're getting at. As a veterinarian, I think we also got to remember to listen, because sometimes we're used to just, I got the white coat on. I went through 8 years of my life. We got to learn to live. I think sometimes we do fall into that trap of not listening. So it's got to be a legitimate conversation, but there's got to be some trust between me and you, Julia, as pet owners. And
yeah. I just think I'd be too scared to give my dog a vaccine, because whenever I see them, they're like, that one goes here. This one's going to go on this shoulder. The other one's going to go. And there's no way I could remember
Point. There are some vaccines that, according to certain guidelines from the American Veterinary Medical Association and then other associations like AHA, which I think is American Animal Hospital Association, and then World Association for Veterinary Vaccine Health, et cetera. There are guidelines as far as where you put vaccines for different reasons. Mm-hmm. One easy example is, think about the kennel cough vaccine, the Bordetella, if you will. Dogs are going to get that usually from nose and from contact, and it always usually goes through the nose first. That's their route of infection. We're giving vaccines to prime the immune response in this area, you know, 9 times out of 10. Usually it's a mucosally absorbed vaccine, so it usually makes more sense to do either here or down the mouth, et cetera.
Yeah.
It just goes always in the right shoulder. Because you want to limit the risk of inflammation or reactions. Sometimes you do them a little bit lower down. For example, with cats, you don't go high up on the shoulder. I know this is a dog thing, but I'm just going to mention cats briefly as an example. You don't give an immunization high up on the shoulder. You go as low as you possibly can to avoid such things as vaccine-induced sarcomas. That's where I feel like it's better. I know I get that it saves a lot of people money. I get that it saves a lot of people time. But if you were to come to me and tell me those things, Julia, then the first thing I would say, well, let's take a step back. Let's have a conversation. There's ways we can get around it. There's things like wellness plans, pet insurance, et cetera, that can kind of take some of that cost away. I'd rather do whatever I can to help you and your pet, whether you have $5 in the bank or $5,000 in the bank.
Sure. Cool.
My other question is about titers. I had no idea about titer until we started camp. Again, I don't have a dog of my own, but they're becoming more well-known, I should say, that test of titer. Can you explain what all of that is and why it's becoming more known?
No, of course I can. Of course. So we're going to go back in time. Sorry, real quick, Julia. I'm going to use this to finish our conversation about our puppy boosters. All right, Julia, so you got your new puppy. We've gone through to the distemper vaccines probably every 3 or 4 weeks. We're repriming that adaptive immunity. We're getting some immune memory, et cetera. We just had our last vaccine at probably around 4 or 5 months, usually around just towards the end. I'm probably going to ask you, hey, are we going to be hiking, et cetera, things of that nature. If you say yes, we'll probably add the lepto vaccine, as we talked about. If you were saying, oh, we're going to go to Camp Bow Wow, our friend's going to be around a lot of different other dogs, then yes, I'm going to recommend the kennel cough vaccine just for some protective immunity. Kennel cough is very, very contagious, upper respiratory tract disease. It will shut down a boarding facility. And again, part of my job, Julia, is not just to protect your little friend, but also to protect the population at the same time. So it's kind of like a herd health sort of thing going on. Now, when I see you back in a year after all said and done, ideally, I think this will probably make things a lot easier for veterinarians. And I think a lot of vets do this anyway, but I think for me, talking to friends who are vets, we had agreed that the best time to have this conversation about titers is right when they're young. It's a lot harder when the owner has already been looking around online to have a conversation and go over things. So right around that first year, we're going to discuss vaccine titers. So there are some dogs, and this is where we have differences as far as what dog responds to what vaccine. We talked about breed differences very, very briefly, just cursory glance. And we talked just slightly about those rare vaccine responders. Mm-hmm. There's evidence enough to support that some of these vaccines last longer than just a year. There's some evidence to support that in some individuals, can we say 100%? No, that lasts longer than 2 or 3 years. Every clinic has a different spiel. When I talk to the average of my friends for coming to this podcast, we will recommend titers. I usually wait till after their adult distemper. So we'll usually talk about titers around that time. So what I'm measuring is those antibodies, that little pop quiz memory from that pop quiz that may be still be circulating around the bloodstream. And there are certain levels that will indicate that can indicate that, okay, we probably have some protective immunity, we still have some adaptive immunity, some we still remember the questions from that pop quiz, we're probably okay. The gray area with titers, and that's why I think some veterinarians that I've talked to usually say it's probably just easier to just do a vaccine every 3 years in December, et cetera, there's been no problems, or just do yearly, is do those levels always 100% indicate that we're protected against said vaccine or said virus? I can say not all the time, but it does provide us with a way for us to limit the number of vaccines that we are given. Does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah, so in our human anti-vaxxer kind of mindset, I can see why titers would be coming up more known now than they were even 5 years ago. Right. I can see where parents would be going, I don't want to give my dog all those shots all the time if I don't have to.
Right. But then the other thing is, okay, but I want to take my friend to Camp Bow Wow. I want to take my friend boarding. Well, from a herd health standpoint, because there is that degree of uncertainty, some of those viruses, distemper, for example, rabies, of course, you have to have that, kennel cough. Those things are out there. We don't want to just protect your friend. We want to protect the other dogs that your friend are going to come into contact with.
Right.
So you're going to go. So if you say, oh, I don't know, I don't want vaccines, et cetera, that's a conversation you also need to have with a veterinarian. That's a conversation you need to have with the boarding facility. They have the rules and guidelines. Very few are going to provide wiggle room. Do you accept a titer, Kathy?
Yes. Okay. Especially in an older dog.
Yeah.
That's where we will bring it. Otherwise, we are like, no. No. An older dog we get because, well, they're older and they can have reactions. But and then we give them more time in the cabins as well. So they're not fully involved with the general population of camp to protect them again as well as we can. No, but generally, yeah, like say, I didn't even know about it till we opened camp 5.5 years ago. And now we've had a number of folks bring that subject matter up.
So Dr. Bentley, I have one other question. It's not necessarily related to vaccines, but I know we have seen it a lot, Kathy, is puppy warts and how that's another thing that's very, very contagious. And I didn't know about it until camp and really learning how contagious that is. And that is an actual thing, is puppy warts, and that it's very, very contagious. What's your view on puppy warts and how that spreads so easily?
The best way to describe puppy warts, we call it, it's from usually papillomavirus, and that's usually how I pronounce it. So puppy warts is a virus that you could say is ubiquitous in the environment. So you can get it from day camp, grooming, you can get it from just walking up your sidewalk, depending upon what dog has been there before. Usually this virus is similar to herpes virus. So most of your herpes viruses prefer things that are just a little bit cooler than core body temp. So for example, with the human, our warts are always, well, outside the body, you know, right around the lips, et cetera. For the dogs, around the feet, it's around the mouth. Sometimes you can get around the eyes. I've had some around the ears. It's very, very contagious, but it's also sometimes self-limiting. So you'll see these, some dogs will have just one or two little warts. And I use them, okay, leave them alone. Because if you mess with a cold sore, like one of those human warts, you pick at it, it's just going to come back and flare up with a vengeance. There are some reports that indicate it's not 100% curative, but there's enough anecdotal evidence for me to try. There's a product called azithromycin, which is you might understand that from a Z-Pak.
Yeah.
That some dogs, the virus will not replicate in the presence of this antibiotic. And I've used that before to kind of control these little warts. There's some dogs that it's the part where it's causing a problem. So let's say it's right inside the cheek, the dog's chewing on it. Let's say it's on the feet. And this was one of my personal dogs. It was a huge bump, kind of the size, almost a quarter in diameter on her paw around the wrist, the carpal area, that we ended up just going ahead and removing because it was providing a problem. It was ulcerating. So without a problem, I say just kind of let it be. If it's where the dog is riddled with papillomaviruses, then I'm like, okay, we may need to go to azithromycin, knowing it's not 100% curative. And then there's surgery, which I think is my last ditch effort to remove. I feel like there's not a good, I think the jury's still out. I know one of my friends was like, oh, we just, you know, bleach everything, you know, every time a dog leaves, et cetera, but you know, easier said than done, right?
Yeah.
So one individual has a much, much smaller practice. the things that are coming in and out are nowhere near the scope that I think we see around Gwinnett County. I feel like there's not a good way to prevent it personally. I usually say, okay, let it run its course. It usually goes away in about 2 or 3 weeks and the dog is usually fine.
Yeah, we've had a couple of owners say, it's just a wart. No, it's not just a wart.
Yeah, that's probably what I would have said prior. I don't know what it is. It's just a wart.
And so education is really important. We're really pleased that you were able to join us today, Dr. Bentley. And if we have any questions from our viewers, audiators, we'll reach out and thank you and ask those questions if you don't mind.
No, of course.
Sweet. We really appreciate it. And
I answer your questions. I think I may have jumped around a lot of the vaccine booster stuff.
No, I think that was cool. Honestly, if we do have any other questions, we'll reach back out and get some more clarification.
I'm sure our viewers will now get to thinking. So,
and they know a lot about Sugar Hill Animal Hospital, so this is good.
You understand the titers and everything, right?
Yes.
All right, cool.
Yes. Cool. Yes, cool. Thank you, Dr. Bentley. Jill, you got anything else?
Nothing for me.
We appreciate you being with us today. This has been really interesting for Julia, but very informative for me. Science is not my thing, so.
That's almost my issue with these things with some of the new clients, because I tend to get very sciencey, and then I try to like reel it back with analogy that doesn't always get off the ground the way I want it to. So hopefully the pop quiz analogy, natural immunity and immunological memory kind of helps. I kind of like that one.
That was good. That was good. I like visuals like that. That helps me a lot. So
yeah.
I do appreciate it. We're about out of time. Again, I really thank you for joining us today. And I think that's all we've got.
All right. Okay, perfect.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Talk to you later.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Well, I don't know about you, Julia, but I learned a whole lot. Like I said, I'm not a big science person, but the information that Dr. Bentley was able to share with us in that short period of time, because I'm quite sure he could have gone on for a lot longer.
Yes.
But there's so much information that at the end of the day, you just really need to have that conversation like you spoke about with your vet for what's right for you and your family.
Sure.
So what did you think?
Actually found it extremely interesting. It's always good to hear a vet's point of view on some things. It's, you know, you're at the vet with some of your animals and sometimes you don't want to ask the questions. You don't, whether it's taking up the time or just, you just have so many questions you can't think of. So it's really nice to hear from Dr. Bentley and learn not only why things are done, but also his perspective on why things are done and how every vet, you heard him say, I talked to some of my other vet friends and we've all come to the conclusion of this. And it just goes to show you that everybody thinks differently about everything, but just to hear all these different points of views, it was really intriguing to me. And I like the sciencey side of things. I can sit there and listen to that stuff all day long. So for me, it was a really, really great learning moment.
Cool. Yeah. And I'm sure it's like any doctor, I go in and I have all these questions before I get there and then I forget.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, and I'm quite sure that if anybody does have questions off this podcast, they can, we'll post this episode link on our Facebook page. And if you have any questions, please write them in there and we'll get you an answer.
Yeah, absolutely.
A starting point for the answer to your question.
Sure thing. And Kathy, I do want to take the time to mention this week's Atlanta Humane Society shout out of the week. There is a sweet little brindle, really a tri-colored brindle pit bull named Sandy, who's at the Atlanta Humane Society. She's actually coming up on almost 400 days of staying with them. So she's been there for over a year now. She has the best personality. She is super sweet, super loving, has so much love to give. I strongly, strongly recommend anybody going and visiting Sandy. If you want to see a little bit more about what she looks like prior to going in, there's a sweet video of her on their Instagram page. Their Instagram is just Atlanta Humane. So you can find that there. And I encourage you to look not only at Sandy, but all of your other animals as well.
Very cool. So I think that wraps us up. Yes?
Yep. I think so.
So again, shout out to Camp Bow Wow for their sponsorship of this episode. And I'm Kathy Stone.
And I'm Julia Elliott.
And this is
All About Dog.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.